started. Coming to you live from the basement of the Brightcliff home, it's the Hand Plus podcast brought to you by Movie Changeup, where each week I, Joe Fricke, and my co-host Tristan Mayer break down this week in streaming. We'll tell you what's happening, what's popping off, what's popular, should you watch it, should you avoid it, and maybe we'll recommend you some things you haven't heard of, some of you didn't know existed. So, yeah, we're just here to let you know what you should be watching, what you should be avoiding. Like I said, Tristan, I'm going to ask you the same question I ask you at the beginning of every episode. How was streaming this week? How was your streaming experience?
I think it was horrific, Joe, in the best way possible. A lot of stuff dropped. I think you mentioned in the preview that October 7th was like the big drop day where all of a sudden everyone was dropping their new stuff, and it hit. You know, I had a really great week this week. A lot of new stuff to watch, which is always exciting, but also a lot of old stuff. And I know a really highly anticipated series we wanted to talk about dropped this week that you're going to do a preview on. So I'm excited to hear your take on that, because I know you're a big fan of the creator of that series. So yeah, a lot of stuff to talk about. And yeah, I thought every platform honestly had something to fire around this week.
Yeah, definitely. I remember, like, if you watched our show or if you watched last week's episode, basically what we do the first episode of every month is we do a top 10 upcoming that month. And I think a large portion of our top 10 had October 7th releases, and that was across all platforms. So we knew this was going to be a busy week. But now with our reform schedule, kind of the last week of every month is going to allow us to kind of catch up and give us time and allow us to talk about things we maybe have missed this month. So it doesn't feel as jam-packed as it maybe would have in our old format, but still heavy week. A lot came out this week that I'm excited to talk about. First off, let's kick it off with, we're kind of going to do a joint topic, because normally we break these conversations up by streaming platform, but Hellraiser, the 1987 original, dropped on Amazon Prime recently, and then we got the new 2022 Hellraiser dropped on Hulu this last week. And we figure there's no point in talking about the new Hellraiser and then talking about the old one in a completely separate separate conversation. Makes sense. Let's just talk about them both. I'm not going to lie, I've not seen either Hellraiser. I've seen images, I've seen scenes. It's never really stuck out to me. It's never really been something that necessarily appealed to me. But Tristan, this is very much up your alley, up your genre. Tell me about it. Should I be watching Hellraiser?
Well, I'll start with the classic, Joe, the one that everybody knows, everybody's heard about it, from 1987, the original Hellraiser, directed and written by Clive Barker, based off of his short story and his own novel. So it's definitely like his kind of passion project, you know, it's something he's very attached to and very much a part of his thematic and his writing. So the story of this, if you haven't heard of Hellraiser, is about a mystery box, a sort of magic little box. It looks sort of like an Egyptian Rubik's Cube, I would describe it. And this box unlocks the secrets of like ancient pain and ancient pleasure that brings out these Cenobites, these kind of creatures from hell that are feasting on the pleasure and the pain of human suffering and human pleasure. So now people who seek this intense pleasure, they have that kind of hedonistic desire to seek that highest possible pleasure. They gotta then deal with the highest possible pain too. So you have these terrifying creatures that literally feast on the pain of human beings. So you get really intense body horror, really, really terrifying sequences, really kind of like hellish, surreal visuals. I love this movie. The first time I watched it, I was pretty inebriated. I would describe myself as inebriated in that moment. So I was, when I rewatched it this week, I was curious, is this going to be as good when, you know, I'm so sober-minded, really trying to watch this. And I thought it was great. There's some really, really exciting camera angles, but and stuff like that. But what you're really watching it for is the practical effects of body horror, the kind of crazy visuals they're going to provide. You've seen Pinhead, but there's a bunch of different creatures that are all, honestly, Pinhead's like one of the more normal looking ones. So you get a lot of crazy creatures in this and a lot of really strange visuals. And that was something that I love about the first one. I recommend watching the first Hellraiser for sure. It's streaming on Prime, like I said, but if you don't have Amazon Prime. It's all good. It's kind of all over the place. It's also on Shudder, and if you haven't paid for either one of those, you can watch it for free on Pluto and Tubi. It's definitely a classic of its time, and if you like body horror, you like gore, this is a must watch for that kind of a horror fan.
All right, yeah, it's definitely something that I'm gonna check out. You know, it's spooky season, you're trying to watch horror movies, it's definitely one I may check out, especially knowing that it's available to watch.
Yeah, it's available all over the place. Unlike that, though, is the new Hellraiser from 2022. It was a Hulu original, so you gotta have Hulu to watch this one. This was directed by David Bruckner. He directed the Nighthouse last year. 2020, actually, 2 years ago at this point. But that was a really well-done movie on HBO Max, I believe, right now. A couple episodes of the Creepshow series on Shudder. And I also last week mentioned the VHS series, and he got his start on the first VHS film. He did one of the segments on VHS, and now he's been doing some pretty solid streaming work, The Ritual for Netflix, and now his latest is Hellraiser. I enjoyed this one, and not as much as the first one. I'll get into some of my problems in a bit, but what I did like about this was I thought the Cenobites they added to this and the kind of expansion they did to the lore here is really, really exciting. And the premise is similar to the original movie, but this is not like a soft reboot. It's not set in the same universe of the original Hellraiser. You don't have to watch any of the Hellraiser sequels, even the original Hellraiser, to watch this. It's very much its own story, and it feels like its own story. It doesn't feel like a movie that came out back, you know, in the 80s. It feels like a contemporary movie. It almost feels like an early 2000s movie in some ways. It's very much about like figuring out the mystery and figuring out the rules of the Cenobites and the rules of the mystery box. And that was not something that the first Hellraiser had any interest in. It was the first Hellraiser is like, okay, we have this crazy box. It brings out these crazy demons. Let's just kind of roll with it, you know. And this one kind of tries to get into the lore and the history and the rules. And I enjoy that in my horror a lot. You know, I really like kind of the folk horror that's about like, oh, there's this legend in the town. You got to do this specific thing in a specific time, a specific night to like unleash, you know, the bye-bye man or whatever. I kind of enjoy those kind of movies, and this has that in it, so I enjoyed that part of it. But the problem is, I mentioned in the last movie that the body horror and the gore and the practical effects and the crazy creatures, that's kind of like what you watch this for. You know, there's parts in the original movie where guys have like fish hooks in their faces and they're being pulled apart. Like, that is some brutal stuff to see, and this does not necessarily have a lot of that brutality. It feels brutal for the contemporary world of horror. That's not necessarily very brutal, but it's not as brutal as something like Barbarian, something that like just came out, like Barbarian, like Melodin, I thought was pretty brutal at points. Even Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like those are some of the contemporary horror revivals that I'm looking at, and this doesn't necessarily have that level of energy to it. It's an all right revival of Hellraiser. I like that it's not set in the same continuity. I like that they were able to kind of play with it and do their own thing plot-wise, character-wise, lore-wise, but doesn't necessarily hook me horror-wise. I never felt kind of terrified or, you know, shocked at what I was seeing, and I think that's kind of what I want out of the Hellraiser movie. I want to be kind of like, I can't believe I saw that. And the fact that I saw gorier visuals and smile compared to this is a little bit of a interesting conundrum. I would not have expected that, and that's my biggest disappointment. It doesn't necessarily have the shock value that I want out of Hellraiser, but if you are into like the mystery side of horror, the folk horror, the kind of urban legend side of horror, I think you'll like this. And it has some gore, you know, so you'll have that gore there. It's just not as gory as I would have wanted from it.
Okay, all right, definitely sounds one. If I got time, I'll check it out. I got Hulu now. I mean, I've had Hulu for about a month and a half now, but I don't pay for it. My girlfriend does, so makes it easier for me. And then also, you also, I believe, watched The Invisible Man on Amazon Prime as well.
I did. I did a similar thing with this. I watched both of the Hellraisers, and I decided I'd do the same thing for a couple of different remakes here. So the original Invisible Man, the 1930s-something version, is on Peacock right now, along with a bunch of the Universal horror movies. So if you want to watch some of the old classics, they're on Peacock. A couple of them are also on Criterion Channel, so if you have the Criterion Channel, check it out. But yeah, I watched both Invisible Mans, and I was surprised just because they're so different from each other. Oh, yeah. Compared to Hellraiser, where the premise is similar, a lot of like the visuals are kind of similar, These are not similar. The original Invisible Man, I guess it's like it's about an invisible man. It's kind of about the town turning against this one guy who's kind of just there, and they fear him because he's different than they are, and he's kind of lashing out against them because of his own anxiety, his own stress, and it's sort of about people turning against each other in a way, not necessarily about the horror. And that's something they brought into the remake, where it's, the remake is a totally different premise, where Elizabeth Moss plays this woman who her husband is kind of abusive and gaslighting and narcissistic, and he dies, but she kind of believes that maybe he's around as a ghost, maybe he's there, you know, some invisible man there lurking around trying to haunt her post-mortem. And it's sort of about gaslighting and about people in her world not believing her. And I like that switch up. I like that it's kind of about Elizabeth Moss as being the invisible one. She's the one who is not being seen, not being heard, even though she's not physically invisible. She's not being, you know, seen by society at all, not believed at all. And I really like this remake. I've seen this before. I have a kind of unique story with it because I watched it at a drive-in because it came out right at the early stages of the pandemic. So theaters were not open by me. So I drove an hour and a half to watch The Invisible Man and The Wretched, a double feature of two horror movies. It was a long drive for that level of a presentation. But it was fun because The Wretched, it turned out, it was there. Improvised premiere. The cast was there, the director was there. They didn't get to do a premiere at a theater, so they showed up at the drive-in and did a premiere with the whole cast and crew at the drive-in that I was at. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, I like The Invisible Man. You go for it, Joe. What do you got to say?
Yeah, I saw The Invisible Man when it came out in theaters. I think it's the second to last movie I saw before theater shut down. Last one was Bad Boys for Life, which was great. But I thought it was really well done. I thought this would kind of be, I know they tried the kind of universal monster movies before. They tried it with Dracula Untold, and that wasn't received well, so they pushed it back, and then they tried it again with The Mummy with Tom Cruise. And then they hit with this, and I'm curious, I almost wonder if we live in a non-pandemic world, if maybe they would have tried to do more different modern takes on the various universal monster movies to ultimately combine them. But
I'm really going with it. I'm not quite sure how it did box office wise, you know, because it came out right at the heart of the pandemic times. But yeah, I love this, especially compared to the Dark Universe stuff they were doing. This would have been a great direction for them to go. You take the idea and the premise, but you do like a totally different modern take on it. Don't turn it into like an action movie type of thing. Turn it into like a contemporary horror thriller with a totally different take.
Yeah, it felt more like an A24 horror movie than like an action adventure movie, which is what they tried to turn it into. Like, I would have loved to see, this version of Frankenstein, or what's this version of The Mummy or Dracula or any of them. I just think you just take the very simple idea of it's an invisible person. Boom, go. It's a person who was, a dead body, basically reanimated, brought to life. Like, what's that like? I just think would have been an interesting concept to kind of do. It wouldn't have even had to do a shared universe. I would have loved if they just took that general idea of how they approached the Invisible Man with the other universal monsters, but it is what it is. It's definitely worth checking out. It's a really good horror movie.
And if you haven't seen any of the universal classic monster movies, I definitely recommend checking out a couple of them. They're on Peacock, like I mentioned, so yeah, you got Wolfman, you got Dracula, you got a bunch of those iconic classics on there, so I definitely recommend watching them. Invisible Man is one of the better of the Universal classic movies, at least in my opinion, so I recommend checking out that for sure.
All right, and with that, I believe we advance to Netflix, which is mainly my topic.
Yeah, I got nothing on Netflix, so it's all you this topic. I'll be taking a breath for a while.
All right, so the first show I watched was The Mole. The Mole, if you don't know, was a show that was on ABC for its first five seasons. It basically ran for three or four, it had a first season, and then it had two celebrity seasons, and then it took a few years off and came back, and there hasn't been a new season in 14 years. The first five were on ABC, and basically the general premise, the original series was 2001. It's a reality competition show, but it's much more in the vein like Survivor, where it doesn't really go into like the fake drama or the kind of trash reality. It's much, it's hard to say like, oh, this is sophisticated reality television, or this is like highbrow reality television, but it's much more, as a reality competition show, it's much more focused on strategy and thinking and the puzzles and the challenges rather than like in fake scripted interpersonal drama. Essentially, what the premise of the show is, I believe there's 12 people, maybe more, 12 people all who are competing in various challenges to add money to the pot that the winner will eventually receive. And what they all know is one of them is a production plant who knows the answers to all the puzzles, knows the answers, knows everything beforehand. And their only goal is to sabotage them and keep them from adding money to the pot. And then kind of at the end of each round, they all take a 20-question quiz that has to deal with things related to the mole. Was the mole in group A or group B? Does the mole have blue eyes or brown eyes? And I've talked about it on the last episode, but if you didn't watch the last episode and you're unfamiliar. But yeah, if you're a fan of reality competition shows, especially ones that don't really deal with the drama, or maybe you used to be a fan of the early 2000s reality shows, but you felt like they've gotten too like much about the drama and not much about the show, definitely check out The Mole. The first 5 episodes are on Netflix now. I think the next 5 drop next Friday. And I'm not sure if that's going to be it. I'm not sure how many total episodes they are. They haven't had too many eliminations, so I imagine there's going to be at least more than whatever they drop at the end of this Friday. I'm really enjoying it. It's on par with what I remember of the previous seasons of The Mole. I believe they also have some of the original Mole seasons on Netflix as well. I don't know if the celebrity seasons are on there. If you're interested in the celebrity seasons, the celebrity isn't exactly like high brow people. It's early mid 2000s type of people you would get on an ABC reality competition show. You get like Corbin Burnson, who you might recognize from Major League, Eric Von Detten from a lot of Disney Channel stuff, like Brink, and he's the voice of Sid in Toy Story.
And, classic.
Yeah, there's I'm trying to remember the basketball player played for the Pistons. Name is Dennis Rodman. Dennis Rodman is another one who was on a celebrity.
I know that one.
Stephen Baldwin was on both season celebrity versions of the show.
It's they had a Baldwin, you know. Yeah. They found a Baldwin.
Yeah.
One of them.
Yeah. Like I said, fun show. Used to be hosted by Anderson Cooper. A woman's hosting it now. I don't really recognize her for anything, but she's doing a good job. So I'm very much looking forward to the rest of the show. So if you're hesitant to check it out, definitely check it out.
I really like the premise. I see a lot of reality competition shows, and I wonder, like, how is this even different from any of the others? They all kind of look the same, but I really like the idea that there's like a mole among them. They got to figure it out. It's sort of like a werewolf type situation. That's pretty cool twist on it.
Yeah, especially with show, like, I'm almost surprised. Like, I don't think the name brand of The Mole really carries any weight in 2022, especially because the show only had 5 previous seasons and it's been 14 years since the last one, that they didn't try to like rework it a little bit and brand it with like Among Us or something like that, and try to make it like, oh, this is Among Us, the TV series, and still approach it with the same level of seriousness and everything. But it is what it is. Good show.
Yeah, it's a great premise, Joe. I hope Netflix hires you to make the Among Us TV show.
Yeah, I mean, they already do. It's called The Mole, but...
Yeah.
And with that, the other Netflix show I watched was The Midnight Club, Mike Flanagan's next Netflix series. Going into it, based on what I had read, I thought this was going to be kind of like an anthology series with these kids telling stories as kind of the thing that ties it all together. It's very much not that. At least the whole first season, 10 episodes dropped. I only watched the first 2. But it is very much about the kids in the hospice. Essentially, all these kids are teenagers. It's based on a book also called The Midnight Club. But all these teenagers are terminal. They all know they're going to die. And they just kind of want to be teenagers and hang out with teenagers in their end times. Most of them are like foster kids or kids that really didn't have much of a family to lean on. And so they have this kind of found family here. And each night, I don't know if it's each night or one night a week or something like that, they all meet in the basement of their hospice facility and tell spooky stories and scary stories at midnight, hence The Midnight Club. It's really scary. Mike Flanagan, who is not a fan of jump scares. He thinks, you know, they should be used sparingly and within reason. Set the Guinness Book of World Records for most jump scares in a single episode of television. And he said in an interview, the reason he did this is because anytime a producer or anyone tells him for the rest of his life to, oh, this needs more jump scares, he can say, hey, I have the Guinness Book of World Records for most jump scares in a television episode. I think I know when jump scares should
I
be
know
used.
Jump scares.
Yeah, and it really worked in the moment in the episode. And definitely looking forward to watching the other eight. It's only watching the first two episodes, I wouldn't put it on the same level as some of his other stuff on Netflix as far as series go, with Midnight Mass or Haunting a Hill House or Haunting a Blind Manor. But by the end of the series, it wouldn't be insane for me to be like, oh, this is the best one. I just think Haunting a Hill House is so good, it's going to be hard to top. But I'm really liking what I've seen so far. If you like those other shows I mentioned that he did, definitely check out The Midnight Club on Netflix.
Yeah, I love the other shows he's done, so I'm definitely looking forward to watching this. So you're saying it's scary. That is my biggest concern, is like, I know it has kind of this YA feel to it. It's based off of like a YA horror series. I wasn't quite sure if it's going to go for the same scare level of something like the haunting shows or...
I would definitely say it leans a lot more YA than his other shows. But I think that's partially because you look at his cast, it's 90% teenagers. So far I've noticed he hasn't really reused any actors. I mean, I could be wrong, but the only person I remember is one of the guys from Midnight Mass is in this. He plays an orderly at the hospice. He was also in the Friday Night Lights TV show as Matt Saracen, but I'm blanking on the actor's name, but he's also in this. There may be one or two kids in this as well from his previous projects. I know he likes to reuse people, so I wouldn't be surprised as the episode advanced. Maybe some of these kids' parents or somebody shows up that we start to recognize a few more people from his previous work, but it doesn't look like a lot of his regulars are in this.
Yeah, I'm curious to see it because out of his comfort zone. The tone is different, cast is different, so yeah, I'm definitely excited for it. Next week, I'm hoping to have seen the whole series, so...
Yeah,
we'll have a whole review up for you guys.
Same. And with that, I believe we're moving to Disney Plus and talking about the special that dropped. I believe this is kind of the first MCU special that they've done. Pretty much everything else has been a feature film. They've done shorts that have been attached to Blu-rays and DVDs, but they kind of stopped doing that recently, I think around the time they realized no one buys Blu-rays and DVDs anymore. And... Hey. It's about 50-minute special, Werewolf by Night, about the comic book character Werewolf by Night, directed by Michael Giacchino, who is a famous composer, probably, if not, he's definitely, I think, one or two of, like, kind of active mainstream composers. Like, John Williams is still composing, but not at the level he used to. When he puts a score out, it's great, but he's only seems to be putting out one every other year, where a lot of these other guys are doing four or five a year. And I think it's Hans Zimmer and Giacchino are one and two. It kind of just comes down to taste, who you think is one. But regardless, this is his first big directing project. And I think as far as first big directing projects, he did really, really well with this. I told Tristan I only have one major critique with it. And to me, it was too short. I think being too short just kind of caused its other problems with not having as much emotional attachment to the characters, not having a complete understanding of the world, I guess. But I feel like everything I saw, I liked. I just wished I had maybe another 20, 30 minutes in the beginning to set everything up a little more. But to me, that goes on the writing. I think if they announce tomorrow Michael Giacchino is the new director of Blade, I'm not going to be disappointed. I think a lot of the moments here I liked. No, but Tristan, what were your thoughts on Werewolf by Night?
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, like, Among Us and Werewolf, and this has that similar premise. If you don't know, the setup of this is that there's a couple of, like, supernatural hunters, and they're all in a big labyrinth, essentially, and they find out that there's a monster among them who seems to be tied to an Infinity Stone, and they're set to, you hunt down the monster, you get the Infinity Stone. So I like the premise there, and that takes a nice turn halfway.
The Infinity Stone really or Bloodstone?
Was it I was a red, the glowing red stone.
Yeah, that's fair. But also, so I thought it was.
Wondering,
yeah.
Is that a? What is this? Is that is a Bloodstone a new thing? Is that a thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't know. It's like the Bloodstone a thing in like the MCU comics is like Bloodstone. But what I've like done a minor amount of research, and the woman character, Lady Bloodstone, I guess, is a pretty prominent character tied to Werewolf by Night. That her, Ted, and Werewolf by Night kind of all travel around together. So
interesting. Yeah, I don't literally nothing about Werewolf by Night. I think I read one or two issues of Werewolf by Night because they were connected to Moon Knight, but those are the only ones that I've read. So it was really cool to watch this. So I had a great time with it. I thought the tone was really fun. The performances were all very fun and campy and goofy. I thought, it's a werewolf story. So I think in the end, a werewolf movie is only as good as its werewolf transformation scene. And this has a really, really good one. You don't see a ton on screen of the transformation, but I think that works. You see the reaction. You see kind of a shadow. You see... the effects at the end are really like a practical. You can tell it's actually a man in the costume for a good amount of the shots, which I think helps the performance. You know, you mentioned that you don't have a lot of time with the character, so it helped for me that when the werewolf does show up, it's you get a performance out of it. You see the emotion of the character more so than like a CG creature. So I enjoyed that to it. But yeah, I had a good time with this. My only complaint about it is I don't necessarily like when they add in a bunch of fake film elements to a digital image. And this has a lot of like the fake film grain. It has even at points where the little black blip comes up on the screen that tells you when you switching the reel on a projector, that all is digitally added to this movie that was not shot on film. And you can tell it wasn't shot on film because it looks pretty sleek and kind of like, you know, really crystal clear with that grain kind of put over the top of it. And it's a nitpick, but this would have been like a near perfect production if like it was a little bit longer, like you said. And I also wish it was shot on film, because when you shoot in black and white, I think that it really, really helps to be on film.
Yeah,
especially when you're doing a throwback thing like this. So you want to make it seem like a old 30s 40s horror movie. I feel like you got to pull up the film stock, you know. Disney can afford the film stock.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I mean, it's very much a fair thing that they should have done.
The action was very cool. I love the werewolf action you get in here. And do we want to reveal the creature? I mean, there's a surprise character that shows up, a Marvel deep cut that we haven't seen in the MCU yet.
We can. I feel like if you haven't watched Werewolf by Night by now, I feel like you're not going to be that upset by spoilers.
Yeah, because we got a Man-Thing appearance. Mm-hmm. Man-Thing shows up and is sort of like a keeper of this Infinity Stone and friends with Werewolf by Night in this. So I thought that was a really cool appearance. And when you see him at the end, especially, he looks really, really good and really cool. I wonder if we'll see more of him again. I think that might be a character we see at some point in like a Secret Wars type event or in some kind of featured TV series. You know, if we do have like this dark side of the Marvel Universe growing with Ghost Rider and Blade, I could see Man-Thing being like a character that shows up again for some kind of, even its comedic scenes, you know.
Fun fact, the actor inside the suit for Man-Thing is also the same one inside the suit for Black Chrysanthemum in Book of Boba Fett.
So, oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
He was better in this.
Yeah, so I looked it up. It's not an Infinity Stone. It is like a Bloodstone fragment that helps kind of give her powers. That helped her father give her her power. So it's not an Infinity Stone. If any hardcore Marvel fans are out here watching, being like, it's not an Infinity Stone. It's not an Infinity Stone. Well, we looked it up. It's not an Infinity Stone.
Send us all the hate mail. You know, yeah, we could use the engagement.
Yeah, exactly. Comment how much you know it's not an Infinity Stone. That would really be appreciated, honestly. Send hate. Joe, more hate.
Yes, please hate us.
Yeah.
I have one question for you, Joe. I didn't quite catch it at the beginning. Was this set in the current 616 MCU, or was this in the multiverse? Because they kind of bring up the multiverse in the opening monologue, and I wasn't sure if they're trying to tell us this is in a different universe, or is this in our 616 universe?
I have no idea. It's one of those things where something could happen, and it honestly would not separate. Like, show or movie could come out and then reveal at the end that it's not even set in the main 616 universe. Like, with the whole Deadpool 3 announcement, I would not be surprised. Like, people are like, oh, it's gonna, Deadpool's in the 616. I would not be surprised if the whole thing happens and then, like, the post-credit scene is Deadpool going to the 616 universe.
Yeah, it doesn't ultimately matter very much, but it would be interesting. Mm. Like, if one of these characters shows up again, do we know that it's the character who experienced this story, or is it not? You know, yeah. That's kind of a question to ask.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. I understand that. And if you don't have anything else to
say...
Okay, go ahead.
I watched something else on Disney Plus.
I was going to say, if there, I think that wraps up that discussion, if there's anything else you watched on Disney Plus, hit me with it. With your Eddie Murphy hot takes.
The classic here, the iconic film that I think defined the early 2000s. You know, 2003 is The Haunted Mansion. Surely this aged well. That was my thought process a few days ago. I thought, you know what, how bad could this be? Early 2000 comedy. Based off of a Disney ride. Interestingly enough, I had not been to Disney at all when I watched it as a kid, and now I've been to Disneyland a handful of times. I've gone to the Haunted Mansion in various forms. Maybe I'll appreciate the movie a bit more. And if you don't know for some reason, The Haunted Mansion is a 2003 movie. Eddie Murphy is a star. It's an adaptation of the narrative of the Haunted Mansion ride at Disneyland. And that was the part that I liked about it. I think the Haunted Mansion parts are actually pretty fun, and I think some of the horror comedy of it is actually very fun. There's good gags and fun performances. I don't remember the actor who plays like the main creepy butler off the top of my head, but
Terrence Stamp.
He's in a bunch. Yes, he was. He's very, very funny in this. He has a great dry creepiness that I think fits perfectly for the kind of creepy butler in an old mansion. And yeah, I definitely was inspired more by having been to the Haunted Mansion a handful of times, and you catch a bunch of the references, some of the famous lines from the characters in the Haunted Mansion ride that they kind of quote in the movie, some of the background characters, like I remember the singing bus from the ride as well. You can see them in the movie, and there's like a couple of things on the outside that you can see from the outside of the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland. There's like a carriage, and you can see the big prominent carriage scene. There's even a really prominent hanging scene in the Haunted Mansion movie, which is one of the cooler effects in the Haunted Mansion ride, where they have somebody hang and kill themselves above you in the Haunted Mansion. Disney went dark for that moment of the Haunted Mansion. So those were fun parts, but unfortunately, narratively, in terms of plot, in terms of comedy, doesn't necessarily hold up too well. I would say not great in terms of quality, but it's a pretty fun nostalgia ride. I mean, I had some memories watching this, you know, it brought it back. But I would say if you have not seen this before and you have no nostalgia for the Haunted Mansion ride, I would not be recommending this on your horror movie list this year. But if you do have some nostalgia for Haunted Mansion or Muppets Haunted Mansion, if you watch the Muppets Haunted Mansion and you want to watch like this version of the Haunted Mansion, it's better than the Muppets version. It's actually a narrative, you know, there's some funny moments, there's character development.
Yeah, it's I rewatched it like a few years ago, and so it came out in 2003 and probably around October time. So it came out when I was 10, which was prime like Disney Channel age, and I remember at that time, like, it seemed every break in a TV show you had like behind the scenes content of the making of the Haunted Mansion. Like, I remember them pushing this movie hard. Like, at the time I didn't recognize that's what they were doing, but now looking back, it's like very clear that's what they were doing. And I feel like I've spent more time in my life watching the same behind the scenes featurettes that they put on Disney Channel back in the day than I have spent watching that movie. And I remember when I watched it back, it was probably like 2 years ago, like all of the behind the scenes features that I saw 100 times on Disney Channel just flooding back in my mind. And I felt, and part of me wished like there was some catalog somewhere I could go back and just watch all those clips again, because I felt like that was more interesting maybe than the movie. The movie's fine, the movie's solid. If you got younger kids and you just want some movie to throw on that will entertain them and won't make you want to put a screwdriver through your eyeballs, like, it's a solid movie. You know, it's not, you're not going to leave feeling like your whole afternoon was ruined, but you're also
And I'll say you're definitely limited on your horror movie options on Disney Plus. So yeah. if you have kids and you're like, I want to keep my horror movie binge going, but I can't show the kids, you know, I can't be showing the kids Michael Myers getting, you know, the murder going. Won't be showing the kids Suspiria this week, but you can show them Haunted Mansion, and there's definitely some cool visuals too. I think if you're an adult, you're gonna get something out of it, something to look at least.
Yeah, and my favorite thing to come out of this movie was Disney saw the massive success of the first Pirates of the Caribbean, and instead of thinking, oh, kids like fun pirate action adventure, you know, movies with like a little bit of supernatural element or something, the lesson they learned was kids like movies about our rides, and so they greenlit the Haunted Mansion.
Yeah, and I will say that Disney Plus is making their own Haunted Mansion next year, March 10th, 2023, a Disney remake of the Haunted Mansion, Disney Plus original, starring Tiffany Haddish, Lakeith Stanfield, Owen Wilson, Rosario Dawson, and Danny DeVito. So you got a pretty solid cast there, at least.
That is a pretty decent cast, and after Hocus Pocus 2 came out, if Hocus Pocus 2 didn't come out, I would have 0 out of 10 hype level for the Haunted Mansion. But after Hocus Pocus 2, my hype level's at like 3 out of 10, where I'm like, oh, this could actually come out and be pretty decent.
It's on the radar, you know?
Yeah.
And like I said, I now have a lot of love for the Haunted Mansion ride at Disneyland, so hope maybe it'll have some fun little Easter eggs there for me, you know? Disney Plus loves their Easter eggs. How can you have a Disney Plus show without Easter eggs? You know, what's the point?
Exactly. All right, you ready to move on to HBO Max?
I'm ready. What do we got, Joe?
All right, so the first topic was something I didn't really even know existed until I saw a commercial for it, and that is Batman the Audio Adventures. It's got 2 seasons out. It's basically HBO Max-produced radio drama about Batman. The first season is actually on Spotify, so you don't have HBO Max, but you're a fan of Batman, you can go on Spotify and listen to the first season. There's 10 episodes. They're about 35 minutes apiece. I listened to the first one on the way to work today, and I was actually thoroughly impressed. The cast is incredible. Let me just read you some of the cast names real quick. You have Jeffrey Wright, who currently plays Alfred in the Matt Reeves Batman movies. It's the voice of Batman / Bruce Wayne. Ike Barinholtz, who is in Suicide Squad, and he's also in Blockers, is the voice of Harvey Dent and Two-Face. Bobby Moynihan from SNL is the voice of Oswald Cobblepot / the Penguin. It's narrated by Chris Parnell. You also have known actor Toby Huss is in 6 episodes. Brent Spiner from Star Trek The Next Generation as Data, as well as Independence Day, is the voice of the Joker. Rosario Dawson is the voice of Catwoman. John Leguizamo is the voice of the Riddler. You have Seth Meyers is in the cast. Jason Sudeikis is in the cast. Kenan Thompson is the voice of Commissioner Gordon. A lot of SNL alum. Paul Scheer is a voice, as well as Alan Tudyk is the voice of Alfred. Freda Armisen is in the cast, as well as Tim Meadows. I didn't realize how many SNL alum. I assume there's got to be someone from SNL behind the scenes. It's not as comedic. It's like, it's funny, but it's dark funny. Like, I don't think this is necessarily aimed at kids. It gives me like Batman the Animated Series kind of vibes, but maybe a little bit darker. I definitely think if you're a Batman fan, or you just maybe even if you're older and you're like, hey, I grew up on like radio dramas, like I want to show my grandkids or my kids like the type of stuff I used to listen to, I think that'd be a good thing to start. Or if you're just like, hey, I want something to play on my TV or on my phone while I'm driving to work or making dinner, I think it's definitely something worth throwing on, at least checking out an episode of. I really enjoyed it. I think even if I wasn't a massive Batman fan, I would have enjoyed it. The first episode was great. I'm probably going to do this every day on my ride to work, is throw on an episode. It's perfect. They're like 35 minutes. That's what my commute is on the way to work. It's really well made and really, really good.
I'll check it out for sure. I've been seeing that on Spotify. I did not realize it was also on HBO Max. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I do love an audio drama. Doctor Who has some really good audio dramas like out there still. Superman has some good ones. Star Wars is an audio drama. So yeah, I'm kind of a kind of a fan of radio dramas, to be honest. So I'll check this one out.
Yeah, the voice that I was scrolling through, I was like, I feel like this is Matthew McConaughey. I was looking through IMDb, I realized it's Seth Meyers, but I guess they have a similar voice, and I've never noticed. But with that, I believe we're sticking with HBO Max and moving on to episode 8 of House of the Dragon. I'm probably not going to do a deep dive, because if you're not watching House of the Dragon, anything we say isn't going to convince you. But I thought this
was... Yeah, what's the point of spoiling at this point, you know?
Yeah. I thought this
but
was
I really, I thought yeah, this episode yeah. was great, Joe. I want to hear your take. Give me your thoughts.
Yeah, I thought this was really well done. Honestly, the best episode that they've done, and I'm gonna say no question, pound for pound, first 8 episodes compared to first 8 episode, I think this blows Game of Thrones out of the water. And I thought Game of Thrones when it came out, this is the best show on television right now. I mean, mm-hmm. unless you hate fantasy or you hate, if you hated Game of Thrones, this isn't good, like that much better that it's gonna change your opinion. But if you loved Game of Thrones and season 8 soured you, and so you're not watching House of the Dragon, I would say get on that House of the Dragon hype train, because different people are in charge. It's not the same team. It's peak Game of Thrones right now, and I'm loving it.
Yeah, I would not put it on the level of season 1 of Game of Thrones for me, but I'm definitely loving it. I'm really compelled by the characters here. The narrative is so compelling too. Like, there's just so many big movements and twists every episode. It feels like there's some kind of huge moment in the arc of one of these characters, if not all of these characters. And I also really like the tight focus, especially this week. It felt like we were very focused on like a specific couple of events, you know, and what that meant for these specific couple of characters. It doesn't have the grand scale and the slow build of Game of Thrones. So I'm liking that for sure. And we have an all-time performance in this episode from Paddy Constantine as King Viserys. As if you've been following the show, you know that he's been kind of getting old and decaying and getting old and old and old as these time jumps have gone along. And yeah, he's like barely holding together this episode, but he is able to deliver a really, really passionate, moving performance that I think is like an award caliber performance. Now, if this is going to be an Emmy cleanup, I think this is the episode. This is the episode that they submit for him. You know, yeah. Give him the Emmy for this performance here, and he deserves it for it.
Oh yeah, definitely. This was like him walking up in that moment was basically him walking up for the Emmy.
Mm-hmm. That was him going up. They're playing the music. You can hear it. You know, walking up, getting the trophy.
Yeah, definitely. It was a great moment, and they're great. I don't want to spoil it, but did you see that moment was ad-libbed or like it was accidental?
I did. I didn't know that good moment. That's a great moment. But yeah, to find out it was ad-libbed is really interesting. Yeah. You know, that's a character-defining moment for that character.
Yeah. It was a great moment. It fit. It was perfect. And I don't want to say too much because trying to keep these episodes shorter. But when the season is over, we will do a big House of the Dragon wrap-up episode.
I will say my biggest problem with this series so far, especially in the last couple episodes, has been the time jumps. I think they're really disorienting, especially when you're recasting so many people, but not everyone. You know, it's kind of strange that like Kristen Cole hasn't been recast, but the leads of the show have been recast, and it's kind of like I'm hoping that season 2 is a bit more stable on the timeline, because I think that'll really, really help things. Because as of now, the pacing of those time jumps is what's holding me back from having this be like a Game of Thrones level show to me, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's hurting the character development a lot, especially when you get to episodes like this where the character arcs are reaching a fever pitch. I feel like we missed a lot of important time in those character arcs, but we'll talk a lot about that once we get to the full season breakdown and I can get into more detail of moments that I think didn't work as quite as well as they may have if they were paced a little bit more evenly.
Yeah, that's fair. And before we get to our end parts, I will talk quick about Paramount Plus, and that is The Real Love Boat. And by The Real Love Boat, I mean a bad show. It's if you've seen The Love Boat, it's basically, it's singles falling in love and the people on the boat helping them. And then CBS essentially lost the rights to Love Island because they wanted to keep it more tame, and that's in PG, and that's not what Love Island is. PG is like Love Island is very much like a R-rated type show where they swear and people trying to bone each other, and so CBS is like, well, let's take Love Boat, but make it real, and now it's a reality show. It's essentially Love Island on a cruise ship. If you watch Love Island, pretty much similar premise, hosted by Jerry O'Connell and Rebecca Romijn, and they've completely just neutered the concept, where there doesn't really feel like there's any drama. It doesn't. I only watched the first episode, but nothing I saw in the first episode, as someone who likes this type of show, makes me want to keep watching. I feel like CBS and some other networks, it's like, oh, we want this to be family friendly, but the concept itself isn't, and the people that like these type of shows don't want a family friendly version. So ultimately, they try to make a show that has mass appeal that ultimately appeals to nobody. And if this show lasts more than one season, I will be shocked. If you're a fan
Dang,
of
Joe
these
telling type, with the roast.
If you're a fan of this type of show, don't waste your time. It's not for you. It's not for anybody. It's a boring, neutered version of your Love Islands, Temptation Island, Bachelor in Paradise. Even Bachelor in Paradise is like more, I don't want to say darker, but more less neutered than this version.
Well, I'm glad you watched it and I didn't watch it, because at least you're the fan, you know. You got at least now I know you're not a blind fan, you know, of the reality trash genre. You at least not.
I have standards, damn it.
Yeah, we got to prove our standards. I was accused by a friend of the show, Johnny Dupe, of liking all horror movies and giving them all positive scores all the time, but look, I didn't love the new Hellraiser. You know, that's a one horror movie this year that I actually didn't like that much.
All right. And with that, I think that kind of wraps up pretty much most things. I believe the only thing we really have left is the MVP. We decided we're going to save the leaving this week, or leaving upcoming. It's just kind of an end of the month thing. It's like, hey, this is kind of what's leaving streaming this month, because it's pretty much when most of the things were leaving streaming. Like, it'd be like the first of the month, and we'd be like, hey, this is leaving streaming in like 3 weeks, and it's a movie that you could watch basically at any point. So we're saving those conversations for our end of the month episode. But yeah, down to our MVP vote. I have three options in mind. I'll reveal mine. You can talk about any options you have, and then we can kind of can come to a consensus. Oh, one thing I wanted to talk about, I was going to mention when we were in Disney Plus. It seems like Andor is going to be in 3-episode arcs. And so we've decided to just talk about Andor at the end of every arc. So next episode, after this arc of Andor, we will talk about it. And then about 3 weeks later, we'll talk about it again. And 3 weeks later, we'll talk about it again. And 3 weeks later, we'll talk about the finale. So if you're curious, hey, why didn't you mention Andor this week? That's why. And so with that, my three choices for MVP all come from the same show. And of course,
the
show I said is the best show on television. My first choice is Matt Smith. Not a lot of screen time, but I think the picking up of the crown and
that's a good argument.
The slicing moment, basically little screen time, knocked it out of the park, home run, grand slam every time. The other one, Patty Constantine, like we talked about. This is his Emmy episode. I honestly think this could easily be Matt Smith's Emmy episode as well. Both great performances, best performances of the week. Option three, the makeup team for House of the Dragon. I thought the effect, look of everybody in the show. People, you know, everyone, like, realistically, 90% of this cast is wearing a wig, and not a single one of them has a bad wig. Patty Constantine looked the age he was supposed to look. You never looked at him and was like, that's a makeup job. He just looked like an old, decrepit, aging man. The makeup on everybody, I think, is fantastic. I think they should win an Emmy. Patty Constantine should win an Emmy. Matt Smith should win an Emmy. And it's hard for me to pick one. It's hard because Patty Constantine's not going to be on the show anymore. But I also look at the makeup job and I'm like, how much of the amazingness of this episode was Patty Constantine, and how much of it was because the makeup team and the effects team did an insane job making him look like that? And the more I talk, the more I'm convincing myself. I think my MVP vote, and you may sway me, you swayed me last week, is for the makeup team of House of the Dragon.
Interesting. I like your argument there. I'll say that I also have three from the same show and two of the repeats from you. Matt Smith, I'm not going to repeat your arguments for Matt Smith. I think he has a spot being nominated because of the Crown moment. You know, it's a great actor choice to be able to stay in character for that moment and to be able to improvise such a character centric thing. You know, I think that's a great touch for Matt Smith. I'm also gonna argue Patty Constantine. I think that's probably gonna be my pick for the choice ultimately, because he had such a great week, and like you said, this is spoiler alert, but it seems it's gonna be the exit,
spoiler, sorry about that.
Of the character from the show. So I think the fact that it's his finale kind of makes me want to give the win to him and hope that maybe the makeup team in the future will have a chance to show off, you know, and I'm sure they will. There's going to be plenty of burnt corpses and, you know, dragon flame and grayscale and magic and all kinds of stuff to show off the makeup in the future. So that's my one argument against the makeup team. But I want to make a last second pitch also and see what you think of the director here, Greta Vizan Patel, because if you want to focus on that Crown moment, I think it's a really, really strong choice as a director to not yell cut right there. To when you see the Crown fall, that's a moment where as a director you want to think, oh, the scene's over, you know, let's cut here, let's redo it. But she saw that they were improvised. She saw that there was a chance here for something good. And I'm saying she, I don't know necessarily the gender of this person, but they knew that there was a great moment here, and the fact that they kept the cameras running, were able to get their actors in a point where they felt comfortable enough to do that and to not, you know, not end that moment, I think is a great choice from the director. So I still want to make the win for Patty Constantine, but I'm starting to slightly talk myself into the director here, Joe. So how are you feeling?
It's hard. Like, I understand everything you said with the director, but it's hard for me to give credit to, if I go back to that moment, I'm like, that moment is why the director wins MVP. I'm more going to look at Matt Smith as the reason for that moment. And I'm like, okay, well then let's give Matt Smith MVP. But I think we have to go with the one we have in common, and the one that I think I was leaning to at first before I was like, all right, what are some other options here? And I was starting to talk myself into the makeup team. And I agree with your point. The makeup team's going to have a lot of moments to shine. And this was, like, when we talked about this episode, we didn't mention the makeup team. We didn't mention Matt Smith. We said this is Patty Constantine's. This is his episode. This is his Emmy moment. This is his walk up. Let me take this Emmy. You're not giving me the Emmy. I'm taking it moment. And I think we have to give the MVP Patty Constantine.
Yeah, he's gonna be handed the Emmy much like he was handed the thing he was handed this week in the episode.
And so our MVP for the week of October 10th, Patty Constantine, House of the Dragon. King Viserys. Honestly, okay, Emmys, for me, if I'm in charge of the Emmys and I'm looking at the nominees and I'm thinking, okay, Patty Constantine's got to have a pretty decent shot. Matt Smith's presenting that award, right? Like,
he's got to. He's got to do the. He's got to act it out, I feel, you know?
Yeah.
You got to hand it off.
Yeah. Yeah, if Matt Smith's presenting the award and he just walks and he does that same thing up to the stage, that's an iconic Emmy moment. All right.
You get me excited for the Emmys now, Joe. Look at that.
An award show I don't think I've ever watched in my life. But with that, I think that wraps up our show. Anything you want to say before we close out?
No, I've had a great week this week, a stacked week, and more horror next week. So if you're not a horror fan, buckle up. But if you are a horror fan, double buckle up, because we have a lot coming for you.
All right. And so with that, I think that wraps up our show. And without further ado, goodbye. Hey, thank you for watching the Movie Change Up podcast. We'd really appreciate if you liked, commented, subscribed, and shared us with anyone you think might be into what we're doing over here. Thank you. Have a nice day.